Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Bauert. Welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability.
Hi, Adam. This is John Krucher.
John, I'm glad we're able to catch up. It's been a little bit.
Yeah, it has been. It's been 2 or 3 months, I think, at least.
Yeah. And this Speaking of Reliability episode came about because we were talking a little bit about customer reliability specifications and how they affect, you know, product development and us as reliability engineers.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting for those that have seen several customer specs. We've all seen good ones and bad ones, so you start to form, you know, an opinion of what you like and don't like, and you get them in all shapes and sizes, don't you?
Yeah, you do. I guess tell me a little bit about your experience with trying to integrate them into a new product development program.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of times, you know, you'll depending on the product and the program, you'll try to drive your test plan based on a customer spec. So if you get one that's well written, you know, that goes a long way, but quite often you'll get specs that are deficient in many ways. For example, you'll get specs that are legacy specs, we call them, right? Where they're just copy and pasted from previous programs.
Yep.
So you're, in that case, you know, a lot of times I think that happens because you get a customer that's, you know, the responsible engineer on the customer end is really not that savvy or, you know, experienced with reliability topics. So the easiest thing to do is copy and paste. And then you're left with something that, you know, really may not be relevant or, you know, appropriate for what you're doing.
Yeah, I find that too. It's, and if you even try to find out about the origins of some specification, it eventually goes into a black hole where nobody knows where it came from. And, right. So what's the value of it? Because now you have something that can end up in like this endless debate when you have test results. You have a specification that then the product fails against, and people start saying, oh, well, we don't need to meet that, or da 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 da. You know, this whole thing happens, and there's potential for completely, you know, negating any value from the testing itself if you decide that the results aren't going to drive a design change.
Well, exactly. Of course, and as we all know, reliability demonstration and reliability testing is expensive, so that's a pretty high price to pay for not having things sorted out early.
Yeah. And then the credibility of the reliability initiative can nosedive very fast as well, because now people can look at it when you come into a new program and say, last time, remember all that money we wasted?
Yeah, exactly. And anyway, they're not always easy to spot the ones that aren't done quite well, but some of them are pretty simple to spot. You know, the most reliability engineers are familiar with the, you know, the elements of a good spec, you know, needs to contain the probability of success. So, you know, what's the reliability and confidence level? What's the expected function? So, you know, there needs to be some mention of, you know, what's the failure criteria? What's the success criteria? What's expected of the product at the end of the test? And then what's the usage condition? You know, what are the environments and usage profiles that the product needs to be exposed to? And then finally, what's the expected duration? So what's the length of the test? And so, you know, those are the things that, you know, you start looking for. And on the last topic, by the way, you know, they're sometimes given in terms of like my background's automotive. So you'll see sometimes the duration's given in terms of miles. In other cases, it's just like hours, test hours, and the what's implied there is that test hours has some meaning, so it correlates or relates to something in the field.
Right, or that they left it that way, so it's a common denominator, and then each application can interpret it differently. Right, so
I would assume that's true.
If you use the same product in different vehicles, each vehicle has a different use case profile. Right, so maybe that'd be beneficial.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe it's desirable to have something that's, you know, very well correlated for your application. But as you say, in other cases, maybe you want a common denominator so that, you know, you can compare supplier A to supplier B with the same conditions, and then product generation A to product generation B, and so on.
Right.
So that's true.
So maybe us as the reliability team, it's our responsibility that when we see the specifications to begin asking questions and look to see it either fall apart or drive a lot of actions for clarification. I know in a recent...
Yeah, you know, that's a very good point. I think it's really important for reliability engineers to be in touch with their counterparts at the customer level.
Yeah.
And just have a conversation about it, you know, because confidence in reliability, for example, drive a test plan. Whether it's a success-based test plan or a test-to-failure plan, there's heavy implications, right, in terms of sample size, which, of course, is cost, and then the duration that's specified on the test spec will influence your test plan in terms of the test duration. So, once again, more cost, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then, of course, the other thing that's and I've seen this, and I don't know, Adam, if you have or not, but reliability and confidence, for those that really aren't that experienced in the field, they'll sometimes just put high values on those because higher is better, right?
Oh, yeah. Confidence. And then they find out what it means and they freak out. They're like, wait, exactly. The test for how long? How many units? We can't do that. I'm like, all right, well, then let's lower the goal. And then they say, oh, but upper management won't allow us to lower it. I'm like, all right, well, we're in a pickle then.
Yeah, so. But the upper management is, you know, is hung on to that goal because, you know, somebody at the customer specified it. And so everybody just assumes it's, you know, based on some kind of rigor. But I think that, you know, like you said, that needs to be challenged or at least discussed with the customer.
Yeah.
And then of course, on our end, our end being the, the supplier end, let the customer know what the implications are. So, you know, if this is the reliability, you know, if you're asking for 99% reliability with 90% confidence, you know, here's how I have to meet it. You know, here's the sample size. Here's whether it's success-based or test to failure, it's still a pretty lofty goal to meet.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's funny because even just this morning I was having a call and with a customer I'm working with, and we're trying to define specifications for what a reliability test will look like and what, of course, is driving better use case definition. And we were looking at some of the inputs that were coming from, you know, the original product specification document. And one was, you know, these two components when assembled by the customer won't wiggle, you know, and it's like, okay, what does that mean? Like, how do we even then interpret that or find a baseline? Now, since that's a historical term they've used before, we're trying to figure out a way to compare it to what they considered satisfactory previously. So the ambiguity alone is going to drive a lot of action to where I'm hoping to direct it to, where I know people that we inquire, you know, about it and history on it are going to kind of give us a, like, I don't know, or it was kind of this or kind of that. It almost, if we take advantage of the opportunity, gives us the opportunity to create the specification as to what it means. And, you know.
Yeah, I guess that is true, right? If it's ambiguous, then you're actually serving the company well by, generating some kind of explicit quantitative measurable definition of, in your case, wiggle, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, we're going to take a moment and do a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Kirk Gray here to mention that John Paskowitz and I published a book, Next Generation Halton Haas, Robust Design of Electronics and Systems, which provides the basics of applying Halton Haas and reveals how Halton Haas can discover software issues also. To find out more and get a copy, go to exindoreliability.com/go/halt.
Yeah, John, it's, you know, it is interesting to see that in some ways it does make an opportunity for us to take control and drive the full definition of a full use case and environmental case. And in some ways, as the reliability engineer, that's our role, right? Kind of as the gatekeeper of that information and flow, we're the ones who stop it from just continuing to get passed along the way it has been.
Right. Yeah. And so every element of the spec has huge ramifications. So, you know, like a lot of things in engineering, you know, the weight that you put on upfront work, you know, pays great dividends, and this is no exception. So, yeah, like in your case, the defining wiggle, that's, you know, if you don't do it well up front, then, you know, that's going to bite you in a big way. You'll run your tests and there'll be a lot of conversation and bargaining and, you know, shuffling about did it pass or fail, and it's all hinges on not having wiggle, in your case, defined very well.
Yeah, I always call it the speak now, forever hold your peace moment, because all that debate and discussion, I feel like it's the reliability engineer's role to push all that up front. So that all that debate and discussion happens up front, decisions are made, it gets locked down, speak now, forever hold your peace. You don't have the opportunity any longer to argue the test results, whether they apply or not. So in other words, if we say it failed the wiggle, blah, 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 you can't come in then and say, well, no, that's an okay amount of wiggle. It's like, no, we had that conversation 3 months ago, and here's a document that we all signed off on. So I think it is important to put that milestone in there of the speak now or forever hold your peace on you know, defining these use cases and what a failure and environment and all that.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, a good customer spec will have that on there, although sometimes the customer specs are written generally, and you need to get, when you get down to the level of the test, then, you know, you got to get explicit at that point. But surely everybody on the team, including the customer, needs to be in agreement that, yep, this is a success and this is a failure. So there's no tap dancing at the end of the game.
Yeah. Oh, there'll be tap dancing. It's just at least you can try to cut it off with some ammunition.
You can manage it just a bit, right?
Yeah, and then, of course, the interesting thing, too, is when you start digging into the specifications, that there's a bit of question where they came from, is the then beginning to include other groups, right? Because the reliability specifications really should be serving the business objectives. So is the reliability specification coming from regulatory? And then, like, if you're medical, you know, and it's the FDA, or is it coming from a target market that you want to hit, where marketing and sales and any other people that were involved with deciding to create and distribute this product, what were they thinking that was critical? Is reliability a critical part of the brand, or is it cost point? Because you can, if cost point is going to be the thing that does it, you can compromise reliability, you know, and that might be the smart thing to do for that specific market you're targeting. Or it could be the other way around, where people are willing to pay more for high reliability, and that's your target market. So there's a lot of value, I think, if in doing this, you can connect it to the business case. And then, of course, also ensuring that it ties into your regulatory requirements. But I see so often, I see this kind of, nobody's looking at the origins of why you would have a specification.
Yeah, I think everybody looks at these things and they think it's, you know, it's set in stone for a reason, because, you know, somewhere at some point, someone, you know, did a lot of this study and measurement and thorough, you know, examination of all the factors that you mentioned, business factors and marketing factors and regulatory and so on, and that the spec is very mature and so on. But I think it's healthy to challenge that in every case, even if you're dealing with a customer. You know, you can challenge in a very professional way. But yeah, that conversation should happen.
It is funny sometimes when I dig in and I can find the origins, and you find out that it's because somebody came from another industry that was recently hired at that point in time and brought it with them. Oh, this is how we used to do it there. You know, and that was 20 years ago. You know, it's...
Oh, yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, what does that say about how tied in the spec is to irrelevant that right. It is to the product at issue here?
Yeah, and there's your argument to pull together the extended groups, because it might be hard to get the attention of sales and marketing or whoever was involved with the business case for the product. But to then point out, like, this is literally floating. This isn't floating, right? The specification, it came from nothing. You know, is this in line with what you're trying to do business-wise? You know, do we want to, you know, you could even make the case, hey, are we wasting money making this thing overly reliable? Because that can happen as well.
Yeah, and it gets a little tricky, because some of that needs to be internally discussed at the customer end, because, you know, the supplier that's trying to meet a spec you know, wouldn't be privy, or sometimes, you know, it's just doesn't affect them. But the spec does affect the cost of the demonstration and sample size and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just that. I mean, what a huge deal if you find out it can't satisfy a goal, right? I mean, there is the burden of a design that's fantastic, just getting enough runtime in a program to demonstrate it, that it can do it. But when you find something that is going to potentially drive a design change, that's devastating to a program schedule to have another, you know, small design iteration and then requalification of this, you know, this next revision. So yeah, definitely if it's not rooted in something solid.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. Cause that's a cost of not having it, a rigorously defined specification for sure.
Yeah, because so many times, I mean, people, you know, program managers are accounting for testing time, assuming everything goes perfectly, right? They're like, how long will it take to demonstrate an 80% confidence? And I say, it'll take X amount of months with X amount of units. They're like, okay, good. And I'm like, no, you're not. That's if you don't have a single issue, everything goes perfectly, which isn't how it works. We're doing this to find issues and to fix them, you know. So right. That's, you know, that's the baseline bare minimum. And, you know, that's an entirely different, you know, it's an entirely different negotiation at that point, because it also then becomes abstract, right? It's like, well, okay, well, how long would it take to, I'm like, I don't know. It depends what we find, right? You know.
Right. And how mature your product is and how much, you know, work have you done prior to launching into this demonstration that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's interesting. And then once you do have the whole regulatory thing in there too, that becomes such an interesting pull on a resource, because the regulatory requirements are not the reliability specifications from the same way you create them for customers. There's, if it's FDA, it's around safety, not just functionality, which is entirely different.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a whole nother pull, and you know, on resource and also on driving design change. You might have to make a change that makes it safer, but makes it less reliable, you know, so it's more of a fail-safe kind of thing, but more likely to fail more often. So now what do you do with that, you know, and how that affects your original reliability specification, that they ended up being competing requirements.
Right, but it equally affects the test plan and the cost of the test plan, and I think it equally deserves some challenge, you know, at least scrutinizing the specification and what it means to the test plan.
Yeah. That's good. Well, I'd love to hear from our listeners their experiences with this, because this, without a doubt, is something that anybody in the reliability discipline has to handle quite often, because this is when the rubber hits the road on what is a specification. You know, how well has it been created when you're trying to make a protocol based on it or a reliability statement? So we'd love to see comments on it. And John, I'm really glad we got a chance to talk about this.
Yeah, me too. Enjoyed it, Adam.
All right. Take care, everybody. Thank you for listening to this episode.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.